Session number 10109, Reel 1.
Colonel Buckmaster, Reel 1. How did you come to be in Palestine in the immediate post-Second World War period?
I was a member of the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Lincolnshire Regiment, and we'd been in operations in Northwest Europe until VE Day. And we were then posted to the Middle East in, I think it was October, may have been September 1945, with an object of going to Palestine to do policing in Palestine. When we got out there, we went first of all to Camp 80, sorry, we went first of all to Egypt, a camp there, to get ourselves organized and trained and accustomed to the Middle East climate, and to reorganize ourselves. Then, after a short stay there, we went to a small place in Palestine called Jalama, which was a tented camp. And there we again did the occasional patrol, but again nothing very much in an operational nature, until we moved from there to Camp 87 in Hadera, which is nearly halfway between Tel Aviv and Haifa. There we had talks from civilian officials, and the great thing that emerged was the attitude of British troops towards the gangs of Jews like the IZL and the Stern Gang, who were causing so much trouble in Palestine. Now, most of the men in the battalion had been fighting a straightforward war, if I might call it that, in Germany, and they respected their foes, and if one of the prisoners of war had no cigarettes, whereas one of the captors had, he'd be offered a cigarette. And the whole attitude of the soldiers towards the opposing soldiers was one of not exactly camaraderie, but forbearance and tolerance. But immediately they came in contact with assassination gangs and people who would deliberately shoot people, completely innocent people, in the back or lead them into destruction from one method or another. Immediately, their whole being revolted at such behavior, and they got a complete hate of all things that were smelling, as it were, of that type of warfare. And we had this lecturer say, it must be pointed out to everybody in the battalion that it is not a personal thing against any individual or person. It is a question of understanding of a regime that is trying to be established. And that must be put over to the soldiers.
What did he mean by this regime?
Well, the regime of assassination gangs going around blowing things up and killing people, either by ambushing or just catching them for what they were, just soldiers, odd soldiers walking alone by themselves. But it was the lack of ability to fight a straight war that made them so angry. They weren't allowed to fire back without orders. And of course this, to a soldier, was something he was completely unaccustomed to, and something that was very hard to explain to him, that he must be fired at. But no, he mustn't fire back until he'd had authority. And this was a great destroyer of morale.
So there was no possibility of self-defense?
There was no... Well, if in a unit or an organized subunit who were on the alert, there could have been a method of sort of self-preservation or returning if one was actually engaged in combat. But the odd sniper or the odd individual, we could not open fire without authority.
Did the troops obey that?
As far as I know, yes. If they were in organized groups, but it was a hard business, and although in my battalion there was no, well, when I was with them, there were no cases of individual action against the Jews in any way, the feeling was certainly there.
What rank did you actually hold in Palestine?
Well, I was originally captain and then I became major halfway through. But the thing was that the immigrants from Eastern Europe were coming over in boatloads, and most of these immigrants had spent their life in a condition of fighting, scraping, poverty, murder, and all things that make a youngster into a subhuman being. In fact, one can relate it really to the IRA in this current day. Still, again, it's the intense feeling that they were going to fight for their own country. And the Jews themselves are a very strong family. Their family is, to them, is something that is stronger than anything else. And when they were offered, from the conditions they were living in East Europe, they were offered a land of their own in Palestine, of milk and honey and all things nice. It was obvious that they would come over in order to establish themselves in the big family, the family of Palestine. And with those genuine ones coming over with good motives at heart of establishing themselves in their homeland, there were, of course, a lot of the people who'd grown up in a condition of race war and poverty and shooting. And obviously, when they landed, they joined one of the gangs and were only too happy to continue that sort of war, which, of course, the British soldier was unprepared for.
Did they differ from the Jews whom you had known personally in Britain?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've got several very good friends and always have had, and still remain so. It didn't colour any relationship we had with them at all, at least as far as I was concerned, because I realised, and most people realise, that this was a fight for their home, and it was the dirty part of it was conducted mainly by people who were accustomed to that form of life from when they were youngsters in their home countries in Eastern Europe. And I was going to use the word civilised, I won't quite use that as strong as that, but other people, although sympathetic, obviously, to having a home and a cause, obviously abhorred the violence that went on.
Was there much conflict at the time you were there between Jew and Arab?
There was a certain amount, but it didn't really have much effect on the soldiers, because their view and our view was, well, let them fight it out between them and sort out. We were not going to be on one side or the other. We were not going to say, well, the Arabs should have this land or the Jews should have this land. All we were intent on doing was to get quiet and peace and a settlement. We didn't mind who got the settlement, as long as the countryside went back to a peaceful life.
So you had this briefing with your brother officers.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say to the men after the briefing?
Well, we tried to put it over. I can't remember my exact words. But the line we took was, as I've described earlier, that it is not the individual Jews who are anti or warlike or murderers, anything like this. They, as a race, are fair and they must be respected as such. We do get gangsters who will continue these actions, but it's not fair to say all Jews are bad and all Jews are warlike. But I said to them, some of these people who've come over from Eastern Europe have lived lives like this for 6 years, and now they're being offered a land of their own. They're fighting for it. The means they adopt to fight for it are in many ways despicable. But this is not our problem. Our problem is to keep the peace. Of course, the family, I want to enlarge on this family situation, that the family, as I've said, to a Jew was the important thing. They were completely disregarding any other person's or people's distress, tragedy, whilst they, to use a slightly exaggerated phrase, wallowed in any personal tragedy of their own. And revenge was their motto. And that once somebody or something had caused damage or loss of life, they were going to get their own back. Now, there were a large number of, when these immigrant ships arrived on the coast of Palestine, there were a large number of observation posts and castles built along the coast to spot illegal immigrants coming in and prevent them coming in. And this was a sore thing to the Jews. They felt that, you know, they were being used to block people who were coming back to their own country and were entitled to come in. Well, there were quotas and things laid down, and certainly the influx of these sort of people was not welcome to the British government. So these forts and observation towers were built. But very soon it became apparent they were being blown up in rather a large number just when an immigrant ship was due to arrive. And, of course, there was loss of life when they were blown up. But, of course, when they were rebuilt with local labour. And, of course, local labour, in many cases, was sympathetic to the cause of the Haganah and Stern Gang, etc. And, therefore, they would plant the bombs or explosives in the rebuild of the fort or observation post. So that once again, when the next ship or when an important ship or boat containing these legal immigrants came in, then offered someone to press a button and the post would be destroyed and in would come the immigrants. Now, they'd joined these boats and things to make sure that their whole life was going to be Palestine, and it was going to be Palestine for the Jews and no one else. And as you asked me a little while ago, obviously this relations with the Arabs didn't coincide at all. So there was quite a lot of internecine warfare with the Arabs. But again, it was relating it to the British troops. They unfortunately, got the opinion that because the gangs of Jews were adopting methods which were foreign to the British soldier, therefore the Arabs were fine and honest and upright and not liable to do any of these acts. And we had a soldier who had, for some reason, got hold of a pistol and ammunition. And he made an arrangement with a local Arab to meet early in the morning, one morning, and to sell him this pistol. And, of course, this Arab said to him, "Yes, okay, I'll buy it for whatever it was." And then he said, "Oh, by the way, have you got any ammunition for it?" "Oh, yes," says the soldier. And he said, "That'll be another 50, whatever it was, I can't remember, piastres, I think it was." So he handed over the ammunition, and the Arab put the ammunition into the pistol and shot him in the head and left him, which came from this wrong loyalty of the fact that everybody else other than the Jews must have been all right. I quote that just as an example of the confused attitude there was by the soldiers.
Was this a soldier in your own particular unit?
Yes, it was, yes.
And do you know his motivation for doing this?
Well, yes, because there was still... You see, all these soldiers had been in a proper war, and there had been, obviously, a lot of gains of captured equipment, and they'd been fighting this war, and they'd got these pistols, for example, and they went more or less, apart from leave, straight from Germany, straight to Palestine. And a lot of them still had these illegal weapons on them. And it was a question of getting some money for something they'd got. And they thought, well, let's sell this.
Where did this happen?
Oh, in near the, just outside the camp we were in. In Hadera.
Why did the Arab shoot him, do you know?
Well, he got away with a pistol, ammunition, and didn't pay anything for it. I mean, the soldier was a sucker who was led up the garden path.
Was the Arab caught?
I don't think so, no. He was just a local, I mean, just taking the advantage of a situation which was advantageous to him. I mean... he was obviously hanging around the barracks to see what he could get anyhow. And he chanced on this hapless soldier. But the great thing was, as I was saying slightly earlier, the impossible situation, which was highlighted later on by the political change in the country, the government, when not only was... permission from the High Commissioner necessary before any return of fire was allowed. But I understand, I may be wrong, but I understand that the High Commissioner had to refer the matter to the Prime Minister in UK, who would then hold a cabinet meeting, who would then get back to the High Commissioner with an answer, yes or no, and then the High Commissioner would pass it on to the unit concerned via the higher echelons, which would take about 3 days, which was a farcical situation. There was a situation where a certain unit in Tel Aviv was doing guard duty in the centre of Tel Aviv in a large tented guard room, and in the middle of the night the two gangsters came up, throttled the two sentries outside, and then went into the tent and pumped lead into all the soldiers sleeping in the tent. And this action so outraged the remaining members of the battalion that it was only through the strength of will and the common sense of the commanding officer that he stopped the battalion or a large part of the town, and marching down to wreak revenge on such a cowardly act. But again, this showed the stresses and strains that were put upon ordinary soldiers, the inability to fight a proper war. They hadn't had anything like Northern Ireland or Malaya, and they were accustomed to a straightforward war where you were firing at an enemy and they were firing at you, and it was fair game. But
When did that incident occur? Do you know approximately?
I don't, actually, because I wasn't there at the time. I think we were in Egypt at the time. But I happen to know the person concerned. I don't know when it was. I just happen to know the circumstances.
Was there any feeling that these restrictions were particularly severe because the government in Britain was a Labour government rather than a Conservative government?
I don't think that that came across anybody's mind, at least certainly not the main body of soldiers. It was just a government restriction. I mean, maybe certain people with political trends thought that, but we weren't really affected by politics at that stage. We were busy with the business of keeping peace and keeping our soldiers' morale up. And certainly within the battalion, there was no political activity at all.
What kind of activities did your unit undertake?
Well, they're mainly patrols and guarding. Patrols was rather an ineffective way because you could see sometimes either Haganah or somebody training with the officers on the horses and the Haganah in... I don't know whether it was the Haganah or who it was, but it was an organisation in semi-military uniforms doing training with weapons. But they would do it out of saying more or less, ha, 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 look what we can do, and you can do nothing about it. There was a sergeant, not of our regiment, who was called to an incident, and he went with one other person. When he got there, it was a bogus call, but he was separated from his unit, and he was just shot in the back, and his body was hung up in an orchard as a deterrent, like a guy hanging up. It was these... it's hard not to call them disgusting tactics that really made the soldiers so wild.
Which unit did he belong to, do you know?
I'd rather not say it.
Can you tell me more about the incidents that going back to that drilling that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
Where did that occur?
Well, it was somewhere near Tel Aviv, I think. I can't really remember because I wasn't on the patrol that saw it. I only heard about it. This was indicative of the type of action that... There wasn't any, whilst I was with the battalion, mind you, I left after, 8 months, I think. So I don't know whether the battalion saw other things after I left. There was no actual engagement that we were engaged in during the time I was there.
Did you see anything of the work of the Palestine police?
Oh yes, we cooperated with them in the full sense, and there was always a representative of them with us when we went on any patrols or activities or confrontations.
What did you think of their work?
It was hard to say, really, because I mean, they seemed to have a very good grip of the situation. And they were all accustomed to the right approach. They were advisors, and they knew all the form. They got information back from civilian sources, which helped us immensely in our work.
Somebody I was talking to yesterday was saying that they sometimes used rough tactics. Did you ever see anything of that?
I didn't personally, but I also heard those things, but I'm sure that it was only as a result of some particularly nasty incident. But as far as I know, I never witnessed any at all.
What kind of background did the Palestine policemen seem to come from?
Well, most of them that I saw and knew about had been in the Palestine police since either before the war or during the war, or and they had a long time of training and experience. And they were, I don't say all middle-aged men, but they were mature and sensible people who'd had a lot of training.
Did you ever make any Jewish or Arab friends whilst you were there?
No. The trouble was that we were in this Camp 87, which was a tented camp with two other battalions, with barbed wire between them. And it was some way away from either Haifa or any large town. So contact with the civilian population was very limited. There were restrictions on going out on the social call, any rate, because you had to go armed, and you had to go in groups of two or three, at least, and in uniform. And that sort of restriction doesn't make for making social relations. We met in cafes and bars, one or two of the local population, and talked to them, and normally it was somebody expounding their theory. But again, we kept to ourselves, because you never knew who or what the civilian was, unless one had known him either before or through other people. And obviously, one didn't say anything at all, particularly on the situation in Palestine, to anybody you didn't know very well.
How safe or unsafe did you feel in going about in Palestine?
Well, because of the restrictions, one limited one's visits to an organised trip with, say, six or seven others into Haifa or into Tel Aviv. And it was very restrictive because, as I've just said, the restrictions of having to carry a weapon and be in uniform and be in groups of three or four. One could go to nightclubs and... but, again, there was definitely no mixing with civilians that one met up with in these places, because one just didn't know who he or she was.
How much did you travel about the country yourself?
Except I went on leave to... I went on a course in Acre for, I think it was 6 weeks, which was out of the direct area of immigrant ships arriving, which was the main cause of the disturbances where we were at the time, where we were staying.